From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly podcast edition from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot. And every week we bring you interesting individuals in the world of sports medicine and general health. This week is no exception. We are so pleased to have Dr. Bob Gold with us today. Welcome, Bob, to the podcast.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad to have you. Well, let me tell everyone a little bit about Dr. Gold here. Dr. Gold is a professor of health education, and until just a few weeks ago, he was the dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Maryland, where he was dean for 10 years, I believe. So that's a long term
right.
For a dean. So that means you did a good job, right?
Well, it meant that or that no one else was willing to do it during that period of time.
Dr. Gold earned his Ph.D. in health education from the University of Oregon, and he has a doctorate in public health with a specialization in community health practice from the University of Texas School of Public Health at Houston. He worked at the World Health Organization and then moved on to University of Maryland, and he is internationally known for his expertise in the application of advanced technologies to health education and has been on the cutting edge of applying new technologies to health education. And so we're so glad to have you here today to talk about using technology to spread the word about health and helping people be healthy.
Well, it's my great pleasure to be here, and it's interesting to be surrounded by this technology as we talk.
That we've been having problems with this morning. Yeah, so many of you that listen to this broadcast don't know the challenges that we overcome sometimes, but those we go forward. You know, let's start off with somewhat interesting question. What are the primary challenges in imparting information in today's world, factual information?
Well, one of the greatest challenges from my perspective is that information is changing so rapidly. The question is how you keep up and whether or not you actually deliver information or deliver people tools to access information when they need it. The standard saying now is that if you're in a technical educational program, at least 50% of what you learn as a freshman is no longer state-of-the-art or even true by the time you're a junior in college.
Wow.
And this year, it's estimated that something like 4 exabytes of new knowledge is going to be created, which is more than the equivalent knowledge creation for the previous 5,000 years.
Wow.
So the issue is, do you base something on current information? How long will that information actually be current? And what do you do once you put information on the internet that is no longer true? You cannot eliminate it. So The challenge is, how do you prevent people from seeing things that aren't accurate as they search? And so these are some real challenges with information right now.
Yeah, and I'm not sure people, I guess, appreciate the fact how rapidly things are changing. I mean, when I was growing up, I can remember my folks making a major investment buying the 1968 World Book Encyclopedia. And we used that for years. But nowadays, you wouldn't buy a set of books because they were out of date so quickly. I mean, as an instructor now, I think about textbooks.
There is a saying that goes back to an epidemiologist at Yale University who used to say that the half-life of health fact is 4.5 years. In my lifetime, there have been 4 food groups, 5 food groups, 7 food groups, my plate, your plate, everyone's plate, a pyramid, and so quickly all of this changes. And the implications of the information change so dramatically as well.
You've used this in your talks, stability of knowledge, as kind of the phrase, which I really like. I think people aren't comfortable with the fact that the knowledge that they base their decisions on may be different in 4 years.
Well, here's an illustration of exactly what that problem is. In the early part of this decade, in the early part of this century, the FDA released some recommendations for pregnant women about eating certain foods that put them at high risk during their pregnancy from listeria. And those recommendations were sound science at the turn of this century. Well, now the FDA has changed its recommendations, modified them pretty significantly in some ways. And the question that they face is how to eliminate all the old recommendations from the internet is an impossibility. So the science changes as we get better at measuring things, as we get more precise instrumentation, as we begin to understand human anatomy and physiology even better. And so the science has to keep up with that, and sometimes the recommendations for what you can and cannot do or should and should not do change as a result. And the sustainability of knowledge is a real challenge for people in public health and health-related disciplines.
Does that make the lay public uncomfortable with knowledge? Because they go, geez, you guys last week said I couldn't eat eggs, and now I can eat eggs.
I think it does. And right now, some people are beginning to realize that the current recommendations regarding coffee drinking has changed pretty significantly. But among the greatest challenges are challenges when a person, an individual, is faced with a recommendation that a mother or a significant person in their life may make, which is not supported in the current literature that they read online. Then you create conflicts. And sometimes in certain cultures, people just trust their family history knowledge more than current science. And that creates a problem for people in the health professions as well.
How do we get past that? I'm from both sides of the topic, as instructors, as people in the health sciences that are trying to get people to live healthy lives or healthier lives, are those consumers out there?
Well, I think one of the greatest challenges for us is how we give people some new literacies. Literacies about privacy, literacies about evaluating health information. Rather than giving them information, we ought to be giving them the tools to evaluate the utility, validity, reliability, and appropriateness of information.
Are there places on the web they can go to get access to those kinds of things that you were just talking about?
There are places on the web where people can go, and I don't have any specific recommendations.
Sure.
But the real challenge is giving people the skills to assess, search, and evaluate information rather than giving them information. I think that's an important way to look at it.
Yeah, because even though we're generating knowledge much more rapidly, but we also have access to much more knowledge we've ever had as well.
And right now with social media and the influence of crowdsourcing and the extension of the influence of friends, peers, and others is almost constant. Even if you're not with your peers, you almost always have access to your peers. And if you have a question, you can ask them their opinion at any point in time. And so this adds new ways to challenge our understanding of the validity and utility of information.
Yeah, because there can be some real poor advice given. I mean, I think of the celebrity who is, and I won't say her name, who was campaigning against childhood vaccinations because there is a mistaken notion that it increases the rates of autism when all the literature shows that is not the case.
Well, it absolutely is not the case, and as you know, there are opinion leaders and thought leaders, and just because they are opinion leaders or thought leaders doesn't mean that their opinion or thoughts are right.
That's
or up to date.
Right, right.
But they still influence a great many people. Any celebrity who makes public comments about substantive issues like vaccines or any other topic has the capacity to influence many, many millions of people at any point in time.
Well, and then I will say on the other side, we've got someone like Michael J. Fox, who has done such a service for the disease community that he's a part of.
He really has, and Pat Summitt now with Alzheimer's is going to be another illustration of someone who has the capacity to influence research funding, research thought, as well as our awareness of this this issue. And she's a wonderful role model, just like Michael J. Fox, and there are others as well.
Mm-hmm. So a person's health, it almost seems like in the future, may be dependent on who they believe.
I think that who they believe is an important influencer of the choices that they make, and the choices that they make absolutely influence their health.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that we can establish rules and regulations for who people ought to believe, but our educational strategy ought to be able to deliver on the promise of giving people the tools to assess the value of information.
And that's almost a paradigm shift, isn't it?
From
the way education used to be delivered. I mean, we used to be taught a lot of content, and now we're being taught critical thinking skills and tools.
That's absolutely right, and I think that's an essential difference in the way education now exists.
Mm-hmm.
Where I had to memorize the names of all the presidents in order in order to pass a history test, I'm not sure that kind of teaching strategy has any value anymore. And yet I know in our anatomy and physiology classes, we're still teaching people that and testing them on how many of the bones do they know. And I'm not sure that there are very many different ways to address that. But I do know that it's become critically more important to give people skills to evaluate information rather than just giving them information.
Mm-hmm. It just continues to strike me that we really are at a crossroads in the way education is delivered and the way information is available.
Well, we are. And with the technology ecosystems that we have now, you find a great many challenges to our old thinking about this. For instance, we now know from the Pew Internet Life Survey that as many as 30% of the people, while they're watching televisions, also have a cell phone that they're looking at text messages or iPads in their laps or some other things or laptops in their laps.
Mm-hmm.
So they are looking at multiple sources of information, sometimes about the same thing. We're seeing increasingly television shows now encouraging people to vote on different issues during the course of a program. I'm not talking about American Idol where you vote for a contestant after the show is over. I'm talking about shows like The Killing or Dallas where they're actually encouraging you to be online during the show itself.
Hmm. So they're really taking interactive media to a different level.
That's right, yeah. And I think that we have to recognize that there is an ecosystem of screens and that any educational program that focuses only on a single screen, a computer screen, is missing the opportunity to capture the audience. Right now we have to design for television, desktop computer, laptop, tablet, and cell phone concurrently.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes it a difficult challenge for a teacher in a classroom with the current generation who wants to be plugged into all these devices, and yet oftentimes, we'll just say the teacher wants them to focus on what is going on in the classroom at hand.
I had an interesting conversation with several of your colleagues last evening about this. Some teachers, when they walk in a classroom, will ask everybody to put away their cell phones, shut off their laptops, and they want people to focus. I walk into a classroom and I tell people to take out their cell phones and turn on their laptops because I want to make it part of the educational experience. There is no single way for everybody to do it effectively. Everybody has their own preferences, but I'd rather take advantage of their interest in multiple sources of information concurrently and build that into my thinking on educational strategy.
How do you keep students from going to Facebook all class period?
It doesn't trouble me that they're on Facebook during a class period. In fact, I will encourage them to go to Facebook and use Twitter. I create a hashtag for a class and tell people to send messages while I'm lecturing or while I'm talking to give me feedback about whether they believe or don't believe what I'm saying, whether they have any comments. And then I usually, under ideal circumstances, if I'm doing a PowerPoint presentation on one screen, I'll have a Twitter feed with the hashtag on a second screen so that everybody can see the comments that are being made about the class during the class.
I can see where that would be pretty intimidating for some faculty members to think that we're going to allow the students to give us comments as we go through the class. I'm not sure they'd want to know some of those things.
Well, I think that it is a challenge. If you're having a lecture of 200 students, and you can get some pretty crude comments sometimes that you don't anticipate, some pretty nasty comments as well. So
students won't say that out loud, but they have no problems tweeting it.
It's amazing what people will say in text messages and in tweets. But the challenge for us is that the inflow of information when someone is on the street or all day long, mm-hmm. they're being affected by so many different streams of information. Why should we think that the classroom is insular?
Mm-hmm.
When the classroom, we're supposed to be preparing them to live in a world in which they are exposed to so many different sources of information. Now, that doesn't work for every lesson in every class,
mm-hmm.
but I think that there are times when it's an opportunity for us to take advantage of technologies in uniquely different ways.
Mm. Very interesting approach.
Not easy to do, but sometimes very challenging and threatening,
mm-hmm.
but worth trying if you are willing.
Mm-hmm. So if you're one of those instructors out there that wants to give something a shot, open up that extra browser window and find out what's happening in the Twitter world while you're lecturing, huh?
Well, yes, and I encourage people to look up additional information about what we're talking about
mm-hmm.
while we're talking about it,
mm-hmm.
To raise new issues, to take mm-hmm. us in to ask questions that wouldn't ordinarily be asked,
mm-hmm.
to challenge the class to address issues in uniquely different ways.
But that really is intimidating for teachers
because
they love to plan, they love to know what is going to happen in class, and they want to have their lecture and I mean, from my own standpoint, 10 years ago, I stopped using PowerPoint in my graduate classes, and it was like walking without a net on a tightrope because
right.
you walked in and you never knew where you were going to
That's
go.
Right. Well, there are two adages that I use to guide my thinking about education. One is that if there are 30 students in a classroom and one teacher,
mm-hmm.
there are 31 learners in the mm-hmm. classroom. And I expect to learn as much from my students as they would expect to learn in the class.
Mm-hmm.
And the day that that doesn't happen, then I don't think the class is being run the way it could be.
Hmm.
And the other is that the best definition of education I've ever heard is that education is what's left over after you forget everything you've been taught. And those are the things that guide my view of how I operate in a classroom.
Right. And I think if we asked our listeners how many of them remembered everything they were exposed to in college, I mean, I don't remember. I took calculus class, for
sure.
example. But if you forced me to sit down and try to do a problem, it would be bad.
Well, one of the challenges for a teacher trying to prepare a class is how do you prepare a syllabus and say to yourself, what do I want them to have
right.
that's sustainable after they forget everything we've talked about in class?
Right.
What's going
right.
to be left?
Yeah. Good question. One of our producers, Sammy Springer, put together a question here that I think is great. It says, do you discover more problems with people who don't have immediate access to technology or with those who aren't willing to spend the time learning about health? And I think she's talking about health problems.
I think that we're seeing increasingly that people are addressing health issues differently when they have technology.
Mm.
They tend to look things up. Even before going to see a healthcare provider, people will look up everything they can about something they might be concerned about and begin asking the healthcare provider questions that were never asked before. But I don't think I'm prepared yet to say that there are uniquely different problems among those who have access to technology and those who don't.
Mm.
I think that we may address them slightly differently.
Right.
But even people who don't have access to technology are just as likely to ask friends, parents, colleagues, and peers, what they might ask the internet if they had access to it.
Right. And I think the number of people that have access to technology is growing, continuing to grow. I mean, the number of people that don't have access is becoming rapidly very small, I think, right?
Well, we used to have a phrase called the digital divide, mm-hmm. and I don't think that it's a functional phrase anymore. I just think that the deployment of technology is so ubiquitous now that everybody has access to technology, even if it is only by a cell phone mm-hmm. that accesses the internet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I spent several years in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was always impressed by the outreach that the public libraries did to the homeless individuals there, and they had great computer access, probably better internet access than I had at the time. Mm-hmm. So it goes to the point that I think there are very, very few populations now that have, especially in the United States, that don't have access to technology.
There are almost no populations that fail to have access at some level, either at home or at work or at play or in the community.
Yeah. Now, how is the advent of technology in the developing world, how is that helping health problems there?
We are seeing the cell phone play an incredibly important role in the developing world. Even in the developing world, cell phone technology is widely available.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing increasingly large numbers of new health programs designed to take advantage of cell phones as the principal technology infrastructure for delivering health information, mm-hmm. access to health care, deployment of health resources, and a whole host of other things.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa and in India, cell phones are being used to remind people when to take complex AIDS maintenance drugs. Cell phones are being used to improve pregnancy outcomes by delivering critical messages at key points during pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing some very unique deployment of health programs on cell phones globally in underdeveloped nations. And in fact, right now, we have what some people would consider to be a knowledge reversal mm-hmm. process in which we are learning from developing nations how to use technology in uniquely new ways
mm-hmm.
because they're already using them as a result of the challenges that they face with having healthcare resources and access in remote and difficult to access regions of the world and poor regions.
Mm-hmm.
They've discovered ways to use cell phones to overcome some of those, and we are now learning from them how to do that.
Mm. Cool.
It is.
Yeah. You in one of your talks, you talk about a YouTube video called Did You Know?
Did You Know?
Yeah. And just for the audience, we will put links to that in the show notes, but I would encourage everyone to watch that. We won't tell any more about it because we don't want to steal the thunder. But you should watch that. It's, I don't know, what, 2 or 3 minutes long?
It's actually a 4-minute and a few-second video, but it's worth spending the time because it raises some issues and identifies some things that people would find remarkable.
Yeah. And since Dr. Gold has told us that all the information that you've learned today on this podcast will be out of date in at least 3 years, we're going to have you back in that time period so we can update everything.
Well, some of it may already be out of date, and I just don't know it.
That's a challenge that we all have, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're running short on time now. We've enjoyed having you here. We always give our guests an opportunity to give us a take-home message. What would your take-home message for us be today?
Well, my principal take-home message when I'm asked is that there are opportunities to use technology in uniquely new ways to reach out to populations we've never been able to reach before.
Mm.
We have in this country a significant problem with health disparities, and we need to find new ways to use technology that is remarkable and available to us.
Great take-home message. And thank you again, Bob, for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. Of course, we can't get away without having our free T-shirt question. And here's our producer, Cheryl, with the T-shirt question.
What do many epidemiologists believe is the half-life of most health information?
Excellent question. Be the first one to email us with the answer to that question, and you will receive one of those nifty podcast T-shirts that we have. We're running low on this edition of them, so if you want to get one of these good-looking T-shirts, you need to make sure you answer. And we'd like to thank Dr. Gold for being with us again. We've had a great visit with him, and again, we will have you back at some point in the future.
Thank you very much.
And we hope that all of you take the time to download our future episodes as well as this one. Thank you for taking the time of doing that, and we hope that you have an active and healthy week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.